You may remember that towards the end of our meeting yesterday, we saw that the contemplation of the dharmas, which is the wisdom contemplation, dissolves things and persons. And on the other hand, the Brahma Viharas strengthens, purifies and perfects our relationship to persons and things. Now, the task of the true Buddhist is to carry out these contradictory techniques in order to get the wholeness. See? Now, how does the Mahayana approach this particular contradiction? We must remember one thing about the Buddhist philosophers. Unlike philosophers bred in the Aristotelian tradition, that A is A and not B, Buddhist philosophers are never afraid of the contradiction in terms. But they solve it in a peculiar way. They deal with all contradictions by merely stating them as such and leaving them at that. The resolution has to be effected by oneself. And a good example of this is found in the Vajracchedika Sutta, the famous Diamond Sutta, as it is called. Here, O Subhuti, a bodhisattva should think thus. As many beings as there are in the universe, all should be led by me into nirvana, into that realm of nirvana which leaves nothing behind. And yet, although innumerable beings have thus been led to nirvana, no being at all has been led to nirvana. And why? If in a bodhisattva the perception of a being should take place, he would not be called an enlightenment being, that is, a bodhisattva. See, this is the sort of classic method followed in the Mahayana texts, which makes the Mahayana texts very, very difficult indeed. We have to become free of our conditioning in the ordinary logical methods of thinking. And yet, at the same time, I think I should add that although these texts seem to be so illogical, if one is capable of really extracting their essence, one will find that a basic logic, a minimum logic demanded by intellect, will not be affronted. Because if that minimum logic were affronted, then there would be no cohesion at all in what is presented. And what is presented will never live as something which has real value. This we must realize. Now, this same Diamond Sutra tells us two things are most needful to the bodhisattva and to his practice of wisdom. Never to abandon all beings, and to see into the truth that all things are empty. So that in his wisdom, a bodhisattva sees no persons. In his compassion, he is resolved to save them. So you see, the wisdom-compassion act in both ways. The split actually lies in our own minds. Our own minds are imperfect tools. That's where the split really lies. Now we must pay some attention to this extremely important concept, or teaching, should I say, of emptiness. It is the all-important teaching. Emptiness is our English word. Shunyata is the Sanskrit word. In Buddhist texts, you will almost never find the word bindu mentioned. In the Upanishads, particularly the Yoga Upanishads, you will find constantly bindu and shunya, the emptiness, occurring side by side, interchangeable terms. Bindu, the drop, and shunya, the emptiness. They use the word drop because in those days they did not know certain things. They were not capable of performing certain physical actions which we can perform today, such as blowing up a bladder. You see? They didn't have these little rubber balloons. And they were unaware of that. They were aware of soap bubbles, but not of bladders, you see. But the drop of water was the physical thing which was nearest in their experience to that which they wanted to express. So they used the word bindu, but they also used the word shunya. And the two are actually interchangeable. Now, I suggested last Sunday night, if you remember, that the root of the word shunya is shvi, S-V-I. And the S pronounced with a slight aspirate, shvi, you see, meaning to swell. And shunya means literally relating to the swollen. Relating to the swollen. Now, our ancestors had a really fine sense of fine instincts for the dialectical nature of reality. That is to say, that reality has opposites, the duals in it. They were aware of the dualism involved of the opposites, as well as their unity. The opposites were opposed to each other, and they also were a unity, insofar as any one opposite implied and involved in an indissoluble relationship the other opposite. This is the important point. It's very difficult to get it. This happens in our own life in terms of the uprising of something in consciousness, in the conscious mind that is, and its opposite uprises simultaneously in the unconscious part, the hidden depth of our mind. The conscious, deliberate, kind intention is accompanied by a cruel intention in the subconscious. It's a curious fact. It's very difficult to discover this, but when you do discover it, you will find, amongst other things, that natural humility will fill one. No sense of pride, of achievement can remain when you really see that and are aware that it is functioning. And it is only when you really see it that you can get the whole harmony and not be tossed about between the two opposites all the time. So now, this sense which our ancestors had is well expressed in their verbal roots. Now, shvi, to swell, expressed the idea that something which looks swollen from the outside is hollow inside. But you cannot have the outside swelling without the inside hollow. You cannot have the inside hollow if there is no outside swelling. You get the idea? Now, you find this. The root, the Sanskrit root is svi, the Greek root is ki. We write ky, you see, but kappa upsilon actually in the Greek. The Greek root is ki. And this is seen in the facts of comparative philology. You have the idea of swollen in such Latin words as cumulus, a heap. Now cumulus has its root in chi, you see, and caulis, a stalk, the idea of the swollen. And we have the meaning hollow from the same root in the Greek koilos, the Latin cavus. They're all derived from this root sound chi. You see that? Now the language has grown up in the most marvelous way as far as all that is concerned. As you know, in modern times, with the growth of modern science and all these strange words which come about when we just take the initials and make a word, UNESCO, for instance. UNESCO has no such root in the living factors of our existence. It is just a mechanical thing, a put together, a sankhara in the very, very real sense of the word sankhara. Now, thus, therefore, we can see that our personality, this thing which causes us so much trouble when we study Buddhism, there is no such thing as a person, and yet all our ordinary everyday experience is in terms of, well, I am here and you are there and so on and so on. What is the meaning of this, I am not here? Of course I am here. Otherwise, who's paying the taxes? Thus, our personality is swollen insofar as it is constituted of the five skandhas. The five skandhas of Buddhist analysis: body, feelings, perceptions, etc., you see, which you may all lump together under mind, the other four, body and mind. See, our personality is swollen insofar as it is constituted of body, mind. But it is also hollow inside, because it is devoid of any permanent entity. If the skandhas are there, they form the outside swelling. But unless there is this inside hollow, the outside swelling is not experienced. There can be no outside swelling minus the inside hollow. Tie all this up with the study of the anatta, the unatman teaching. It's not easy, but once you see it, everything will become very much clearer. It will become clearer primarily because this split or this gap in our own minds will have vanished. That's what will have happened. The mind is clarified, it is enlightened then. On that topic, that is. Now, let us go on. Emptiness, therefore, is not a mere nothing, an absolute nothing, or an absolute blank, but essentially it means the absence of selfness. It stands for self-effacement. Self in the ordinary limited sense of selfishness, selfness, and so on, self-centeredness, self-concernedness, self-consciousness, this I am I, as against the not I. That disappears when we really see this. Bodhidharma put it very tersely when he said, all things are shunya, and there is nothing desirable or to be sought after, neither the inside hollow nor the outside swelling. As technical terms, that is to say, technical terms in philosophy, shunya and shunyata express the complete negation of this world. The complete negation of this world. But in which sense a negation? This thing is here. My saying no to it doesn't alter the fact that the jolly old table is there and will continue to be there. It is the negation of my concept of it, my picture of it. my idea about its nature. It is in that sense that the negation of the world comes about. But the world as a physical world was there long before this person came into being, and his brain and mind were active, and will continue to be long after this person with his brain and mind have ceased to be. So the world remains the world, and no nonsense about it. See, this is one of the very difficult things. You may remember on Sunday night, I mentioned the order in which the grosser elements are supposed to be derived from Akasha, the primordial element, as it is called. The different presentations which you find not only in Indian philosophies, be they Hindu or Buddhist, but also in the West. I mentioned, for instance, Lucretius and Cicero, but there are many other Western philosophers who have talked about all this, you see. And the world as such, the material world which is experienced by the living person, is derived from Akasha, and Akasha is presented as an absolute even in Buddhism. A self-subsistent absolute. You see? Just as Nibbana is a self-subsistent absolute. Two absolutes like that, which is a very difficult situation. What does this indicate, essentially? The split in our minds, our incapacity to realize, to be aware of this extraordinary fundamental unity of the two. The moment you enter into the analytical process, trying to understand what is this, what is this, what is this, then the split comes at once. We always start at the male-female stage. We can't do otherwise. In connection with this, it may interest you to know how Plato talked about this. The male rational principle, as expounded in the Republic, is the principle of good. The Eros principle, the female irrational principle, which is the principle of materialization, concretization, and therefore of manifestation, he stated as evil. See, this corresponds to the Hebraic. The evil begins with the woman. Adam says to the Lord, "The woman thou gavest me did this." And he tried to hide behind her skirts. But it didn't quite work that way. They all got it in the neck. Now, why is this called a principle of evil? Why is matter called a principle of evil? Because it means bondage to the absolute, the indefinable, ultimate, and so forth. We here as we are can't get at it. But we somehow sort of feel or sense that there is a transcendent real. And we postulate that the transcendent real is caught up, captured in matter. You see? Now, things will begin to change from this century onwards. You may say, why? Because all our conceptions of matter, which are born of the experience of a living organism called a human being, have already been shattered by experimental science itself. Science, in short, has dematerialized matter. All philosophies, all verbal statements, all thinking processes, abstract thinking processes, at their root are dependent upon our conception of the nature of things, material things. This is something which is known only to a few people in the world, philosophers, scientists included. They have never thought about this. They have never looked into it. The most abstract thought that a person is capable of, which is expressed in words and can be expressed only in words, derives for its expression from his experience of material things, chairs, tables, breakfast, lunch, wives, husbands, money, property, trees, flowers, etc. If you look carefully into the structure of language, you will find that every single word has its ultimate roots in matter and the experience of the living organism with matter from infancy onwards. This is an extremely important point. You see? Therefore, what happens? All this experience from infancy onwards conditions the mind to relate everything which tries to escape the limitations of matter back to matter, to relate it back to matter. You can't escape it. You see? So, whatever philosophy emerges, and you will find extraordinarily good examples of this in the Platonic and the Aristotelian philosophies. Aristotle was Plato's most brilliant pupil. And in certain very important respects, he completely rejected the Platonic presentation. In these two philosophies, you will find how the conception of the nature of things influenced each philosopher and what he presented. And both had deep and profound realization. You see, the trouble lies in my mind. It is imperfect. It is still growing. It is immature. It is not. It is as if it were like a body where the limbs haven't grown properly yet, and therefore they are clumsy, awkward, where the organs are not functioning properly yet, and therefore the body is unhealthy, and so forth. It's something like that. And of course, the finest Hindu Buddhist presentations were all subject to the ignorance of the nature of things. And this precisely is what science is bringing about. Not that science will ever prove religion. That's nonsensical. But science will enable us, it almost already has enabled us, to get to this thing we call Akasha. What is this thing which was called Akasha? You see? And so the gaps fill up and the limitations disappear. It is very important to appreciate this point. And if we sort of have a fairly comprehensive study of the teachings of all the religions and the major philosophies of the world, both Eastern and Western, and we try to see how the mind has operated in the presentation of these philosophies, we shall be able to breathe more of the air of heaven and not be bogged down. Because it's a lifelong work. Now, the Abhidharmists, and there were the two schools of Abhidharma, the Theravada Abhidharma school, and the Sarvastivadin Abhidharma school. See? Which was in northern India, the Abhidharma in the south, in the southern countries. The Abhidharmists knew the term Shunya, but used the term quite sparingly. And the Pali Canon uses it on a few occasions. You will find the term used considerably in the third volume of the Majjhima, which has the section on emptiness. The discourses concerned with emptiness. But the new wisdom school, that is the Mahayana school, treats it as the sesame to open all doors. And you see, remember that the Mahayana school was founded by Indians, who of course were masters of their Upanishadic teachings. They adapted the formulation of this to suit the Buddhistic frame. The Bindu became Shunya. This is not sufficiently known. One has to see the relationships. The devotees of a particular faith are only naturally, of course, they are only too anxious to keep the other chaps out. They are the outsiders. We are the chosen ones. You know, this tragic conceit dogs all faiths and the followers of all faiths. It's an unfortunate thing. Nagarjuna worked out the epistemological implications of shunya and shunyata. And here, shunyata means, in the philosophical presentation of it, the identity of yes and no. Naturally, it makes all philosophers trained in the Aristotelian tradition absolutely snort like horses, you know. What an absurdity, they say. It's all nonsense. In this system of thought, you undo with one hand what the other has done. The Buddhist sage is like a faithful Penelope waiting for the Odysseus of enlightenment. You know how she weaves that shroud in the night, in the daytime, to satisfy all the importunate lovers who are pressing her, saying Odysseus is dead. And in the night she unravels the thing. She has promised her hand to the one, to one, when she has completed the web. However, shunyata in the Majjhima Nikaya is the middle, the Majjhima. Now remember what we saw yesterday. Majjhima, the middle, not in the sense of drawing a line from this point to that point and getting there, but transcending both. If you transcend the one opposite, you transcend the other opposite simultaneously. If you can pay total attention to what we call the good, you will be utterly free of the good as well as its opposite evil. If you can pay total attention and totally understand what is called evil, you will, in the transcendence, find freedom from the evil as well as its opposed good. That is to say, the relative good-evil vanishes and the transcendent good is present. It is this transcendent good which is one of the meanings of the word God. And in English, because the language is such, you can conveniently spell God as G-O-O-D instead of one O. So shunyata then is this majjhima, this middle between affirmation and negation, existence and non-existence, eternity and annihilation. The germ of this, of course, is in the Pali Kacchayana Sutta, where the Buddha tells Kacchayana, people in the world, some people say this is, some people say this is not. Now, we must remember that in this context, the affirmation this is does not refer so much to material things and so forth. It refers to our experience and our thought, our feeling, our conceptions of reality and truth and so forth. We say, this is the fact, this is the truth. That is, our presentation is the truth. And the other fellow says, no, this which you say is the truth is not the truth. It is to that mainly, I think, that the Buddha was referring. Because after all, the Buddha himself used a begging bowl. Would he have said that it neither is nor is not? It is a begging bowl. It's a simple, solid fact. When he was hungry, well, that body was hungry. You couldn't say it was not hungry. Those are absurdities, aren't they? So obviously, this refers to truth and our conceptions, our feelings, the processes of the mind. Religion is concerned fundamentally with the mind of man. What we call the spirit is something which the mind creates. So it was implicit in that teaching to Kacchayana. The Mahayana presents, of course, the realization that in their emptiness, their shunyata, but remember, emptiness means the hollow inside, inseparable from the swollen outside. Never forget that. The emptiness represents the hollow inside, inseparable from the swollen outside. You see, in their emptiness, nirvana and samsara are a non-duality. Sometimes you get it put in this verbal form that they are an identity. I think that verbal form is a little bit misleading. The other one is far less misleading. They are a non-duality, nirvana and samsara. Now, Theravada Abhidharma presents ultimate truth as statements about dharmas. Conventional or relative truth speaks of persons and things. The New Wisdom School states that ultimate truth is found exclusively in relation to the one ultimate reality, which is the absolute in its shunyata. The absolute in its shunyata. Remember, it is, now this is not something which is abstracted. It is not a sort of a monism which is set over and against and upheld over and against the sarvastivadin pluralism. You mustn't think of it as a sort of a mysterious, wonderful background on which to fall as an absolute. The moment you've got to the stage of an absolute, or even the absolute as such, then it has, the mind has slipped. It has become a separate entity of some sort or other, a concept, and so forth. Just absoluteness. Absoluteness. You can't talk about it really. All this talk is to suggest how we can save our minds from forming more misconceptions. That is all we can do about it. When we really see such things, again, one gets freed of conceit. There is no room for conceit. What one does know, as far as truth in the religious sense is concerned, is that we do not know. We, the creatures, the created, are as nothing beside that mysterious something which is the creator, whatever it is. All we know is that this is how it is here. Now, a few words about this question of salvation. Buddhism, of course, is a religion of salvation, exactly like Christianity is. It is also, in ordinary parlance, scholars' jargon, it is a pessimistic religion. That is to say, it is a life-denying religion. The scholar doesn't know life in its fullness. He only knows life as we play about on this planet. But life in the profounder sense, he doesn't. So, both Christianity and Buddhism are presented as life-denying and as religions of salvation. Out from here, away to there, the Elysian fields, sort of idea. All that is hopelessly wrong. The salvation in Buddhism, in Mahayana, is summed up in these terms: non-attainment. Second, non-assertion. Third, non-relying. And fourth, omniscience. Shunyata, the unconditioned, is devoid of any relation to anything. It has no properties, no marks. If it had properties and marks, it would not be the unconditioned. Hence we cannot know it, we cannot have it. In fact, it has us. We are the passing ephemeral bubbles, so to say, which are an excrescence of the Absolute. Then one may ask, then what on earth is the use of us? The totality comes to self-consciousness through us. This is our usefulness, our unique function, to be the instruments for totality emerging into self-consciousness through each and every one of us. If you like to picture totality as the darkness, the original darkness, that original darkness emerges in each one of us as a point of light. I don't know. I have often looked into that. I have also often put nice little verbal formulations which may be temporarily helpful. They are mere crutches, but they are not truth. You see, here, for instance, the way of the scientist is very helpful. In the old days, the question why was asked, and particularly people like Aristotle. Aristotle was a scientist in his own way, a very limited one, but he was a scientist in his own way, and he would answer the question why. But when modern science really came into its own with the experimental method, the method of investigation, let's find out what is the fact, without any preconceptions, as far as it was possible to be without preconceptions, you see. Then modern science showed that to ask why is a mistake. But to observe how the thing happens is the way of knowledge, scientific knowledge. Now you see, actually the Buddha did precisely that in the sphere of the mind. He was not so much concerned about the whys and so on. He showed the how. This is how it happens. This is how we are caught in suffering, misery, dukkha, ignorance, and so forth. And this is how we release ourselves from the suffering, ignorance, dukkha, and so forth. Ask the how rather than the why. You can ask the why in a very limited context. You see, Jimmy threw the Ming vase out of the window. You may ask Jimmy, well, why did you do that? And you say, I didn't like that awful thing. That's quite sufficient answer. but it takes us nowhere near transcendental truth. In that context, we may ask why. Why did you come late to work this morning? Sorry, sir, I missed the train. Why did you miss the train? I got up too late. The simple, straightforward answers to why. And meaningful answers. They tell you the event, don't they? But in the investigation of truth, don't ask the why. How does it happen? And truth reveals, shows her own face. Now, non-attainment, very briefly, is practically synonymous with self-extinction. That is to say, the extinction of selfness. You see, I want to acquire virtues, but the acquired virtue, the studied simplicity or the studied humility, and the awareness that, oh, I am humble, I am simple, completely defeats the virtue. It isn't virtue. It is the spontaneous, unstudied humility which is humility, and so forth, with any and every virtue. It emerges naturally as a living thing instead of a dead, put-on thing. This is very important. So non-attainment is of that nature. Perhaps we may call it complete unselfness. Complete unselfness, non-attainment. Then again, where Buddhahood or arhatship or any such thing is concerned, there is no such thing as saying, oh, I have become an arhat. You see? In the world of things, in the world of affairs, if you pass a certain exam, you can put PhD after it, or DSc, or whatever it is, you see, and so forth. And that is a fact. The context of that fact, and it is, that fact is true in that context, you see, is quite different from the religious context. The religious context is the timeless context. What does being an arhat mean in timelessness? Nothing at all. It is a misstatement. If you announce, I am an arhat. If I say, I am a doctor of philosophy, well, I'm asserting the fact that at a certain period in time, I took an examination, I got through it, or whatever it was, or presented a thesis, it was accepted and passed, and therefore this degree was conferred on me. But you see the extraordinary deadness of the thing. Whilst the thesis was being prepared, whilst it was being considered, and then finally passed, all that was the living event. But now that living event, that which was the living event, having been completed, meaning that it died, it's the label of death. It's the death label. it's the gravestone which says, here lies so and so. That is the meaning of putting my degree after my name. You see? But in the case of being enlightened, being enlightened, not was and done with, but being here now continuously, it's the timeless living reality. You see? So non-attainment includes all that. Then non-assertion. One neither says this is so or this is not so. One sees that both answers apply and both answers don't apply. You see? As one of the Mahayana texts put it, this sublime doctrine is not a cockpit for logicians. Emptiness is the non-difference between yes and no. Now third, about non-relying, and this is really an absolutely magnificent, sublime aspect. Curiously enough, all that the Mahayana presented this way is also to be found through and through the Yoga Upanishads. The aloneness in its ultimate. One realizes the aloneness. Now we must distinguish very carefully here. To be alone does not mean to be isolated, to be shut out. When I am completely free of all my illusions about self and not self, when I am free of the conflict of the duals, when the transcendence is realized, the totality which has come to light through this organism realizes its own totality. And totality is only one, there is no other in it. This is the aloneness. Now look into Plotinus's The Flight of the Alone to the Alone. And you will see some marvelous wisdom and depth there. Plotinus was one who knew. New in this transcendent sense. And the Mahayana presents it very, very wonderfully. As the consequences of that, one therefore, of course, rejects all supports. One does not rely upon anything at all. One is non-dependent. Not independent in the sense of isolation, but non-dependent, because there is no grasping whatsoever. Lastly, this business of omniscience. The Theravada presented the Buddha as omniscient in this sense, that he knew all that was necessary for attaining salvation. But the Mahayana, personally, I think slightly spoils it by saying that it includes total omniscience of everything whatsoever, including such useless particulars as knowing the number of insects in the world. Now we have a similar absurdity presented in the Rig Veda, in one of the hymns to Varuna. Varuna, the all-seeing God, who knows all the winkings of your eye. Whatever for? You see. Now the Mahayana says that if the Buddha did not know each and everything, then it would mean that he is not one with the Absolute. But consider the absurdity of this statement. Really, it's stupid beyond measure. Supposing a Buddha, or a Jesus, or whoever you like, a holy liberated one, did know all these things, why is he unable to predict the exact course of events, the exact nature and the facts of all the new knowledge that comes into the world through our discovery, our invention, our science and everything? Why couldn't he have given the equations which Dr. Lisa was, what was her name? Lisa, I've forgotten it. And also the Einsteinian equation which enabled the atomic bomb to come into existence and so forth. It was misused as an atomic bomb, but it showed us how to utilize the power locked up in the atom. Atomic energy. Lisa Minor, I think that was her name. You see? But they knew nothing about this. They are quite ignorant of all this. And if they were even, leave alone transcendentally wise, if they were just sensible folk, the Buddhas and the Arhats and so forth, surely they would say, oh, I'm not interested in all that, and leave it at that. It's perfectly ridiculous to present a conception that a Buddha just knows everything. You find this in the theistic religions too. God is supposed to know every single thing.
When a sparrow falls, I think it touches the...
Yes, but you see, if we look at it, not literally, but the Mahayana means it literally. If we look at it literally, it is stupid. But if we see an inner significance in it, a mystical significance, then we are on the right lines. One must never forget that that all the great religions, when they tried to enter into the transcendent, they left the realm of material, or if you like to call it scientific truth. They left the level of psychological truth, and they entered into a realm which was beyond the psychophysical. And therefore it was mystical truth. But how is one to express mystical truth? Only by using thoughts and words. And thoughts belong to the psyche, and words, the spoken, the sounded word, belongs to a physical sound. Isn't it? So they had to use as their tools of expression that which was the not transcendent. In all the religions of the world, in all the texts, you will find any number of flaws like this. This is inevitable. We can't escape it, see? But it is there. However, let's go on. The great good thing about the Mahayana presentation was this, that whilst the Theravada emphasized the idea of escape from evil, Mahayana set its face against the idea of escape from evil. Hence the Bodhisattva idea that I shall not enter a private nirvana until everybody else is with me. You see? The word Buddha comes from the root Bud, and it has two meanings. One meaning is, of course, the meaning we all know, to wake up. To wake up. The Buddha is the enlightened one, the awakened one. The other meaning is to know. And it is the development of this other meaning, to know, which made the Mahayana present the ideal of omniscience as such. Well, of course, it's not possible to cover the ground of the Mahayana not only fully but even adequately in a few meetings like this. But I trust there has been some sort of stimulation to delve a little bit more deeply into it.
Yes, it definitely has. Thank you very much. It's been great help.
Well, shall we stop there today? Yes, I think so.